What's the difference between connecting to place through recreation and through agriculture, or is that the wrong distinction?
It is very difficult to distinguish what I do between the two.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's a real difference between somebody harvesting carrots from their garden and me shooting a deer on the hillside above the garden, except that venison is better than carrots.
It's a lot more freaking work, too. Okay.
Just different work.
These are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash, and this is the Six Ranch Podcast. A hot drink can become cool in two primary ways, through conduction and convection. Conduction occurs when two objects touch each other. Imagine holding a piece of ice. Before long, your fingers are cold and the ice begins to melt. That's conduction. Convection occurs when a gas or liquid moves from being different temperatures. When you heat water over a stove, the warm water moves up and the cool water moves down. That's what you're seeing when water boils, and that's convection. A stainless vacuum bottle prevents conduction from occurring by creating a void between the walls of the bottle, thermos, or cup and the outside air. It prevents convection by keeping all the liquid inside at the same temperature. That's how a Stanley product keeps your cold drink cold and your hot drink hot. And they've been doing it for 110 years. The Six Ranch Podcast is brought to you by Stanley 1913, and you can check out their new and classic line of products at stanley1913.com.
There's all sorts of cool people in this county that I don't know anything about these days.
Yeah. That's kind of the nature of it, I guess. It's small enough that we feel like we should know everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still more people than any one person can know.
Well, and there's more turnover. There's more new people. And if, I don't know if you feel this way, I feel like I've been here long enough that I have my rut and mm-hmm. I hang out with my people and I work a lot and I have kids. And so you know your circle, and there's all sorts of evolution happening around us, and without like a real concerted effort to figure out who those people are, I just hear about them.
There's the Ford Foundation, they put out a publication every year called Oregon by the Numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And it has the statistics for a bunch of categories for the state and then for every county. And it's interesting. One of those is migration. And that is the number of people that came and went to any given county. And Oregon's population has not changed that much. It's been around 4.5 million for quite a while. Wallowa County's population is the same or close to the same as it was in 1900. Our migration last year was 65 people.
In
and out. That's what changed.
Oh, just interesting.
65 people.
So what is our current population?
I think we're just over 7,000.
Okay. Which is, we've been there for a really long time.
Yeah. And in that greater Idaho debate, that's one of my biggest points of contention, is that Idaho votes for land use by county.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which is why if you go to Boise, basically as soon as you get into the Treasure Valley, it's nonstop suburbs and car lots for like 60 miles now through some of Idaho's most promising farmland.
Yep.
Because those counties decided that they were not going to have exclusive farm use land.
Mm-hmm.
We have exclusive farm use, so you can't break up something less than 160 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do, you need to keep producing agriculture from it.
Except for where we have timber grazing,
right,
which is 240 and even.
And then even bigger.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it is that conundrum, because what's good for the individual landowner, mm-hmm. like I could break my 160 and divide it among my kids,
yeah.
or sell off a piece so I can stay in business, is not good for the collective when it comes to the quality of life we enjoy from our landscape.
Not only quality of life, but we need to keep producing food.
Mm-hmm.
We can't just produce more space for more humans on space that was previously in production.
Well, and I think when I say quality of life, that's part of it,
sure,
right? Your totally. Ability to actually nourish yourself
yeah.
via land that you're connected to or have a connection where there's a level of accountability there.
Where do you feel like your story starts?
I have a question before you ask me a question.
Okay. I'll bite.
So my question is, I went on a run this morning and I was excited about talking to you today because uh-huh. we don't get a chance to talk very often these days.
Yeah.
And all I could think about was all the questions that I wanted to ask you.
Okay.
So I have some questions too.
Okay.
And that's my question is.
That's fine.
Okay, great.
We can go back and forth.
Awesome.
I started though.
I know. Well, which story do you want?
I don't know. It's really subjective. And I think that that's why I asked this question on the show, because people will answer it in the way that it makes sense to them. So where does your story start? I don't think that my story starts with me in it. I think my story starts generations before I start.
Because your people came to the land where you now are so many generations ago. So the culture, the connection to place, you're living out another iteration of a legacy.
Yeah, I'm just a chapter.
Mm-hmm. And in that chapter, you think of the land and the place as the constant.
Yeah, I think it's the set and setting and the plot, for mm-hmm. that matter.
Mm-hmm. Because how we interact with the land and make a living from it, near it, around it,
right,
changes every generation.
If there is a main character here, it would be the Wallowa River.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody else is just an antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no.
Where do you think your story starts?
That was another thing. Have you noticed that I'm really bad at answering questions?
I don't think you're bad at it.
Okay. So that was another thing I thought about this morning is the parallels that you and I have in terms of those generations mm-hmm. in a place and the ways in which sort of cultural constructs like land ownership have played out sort of the individual, call it strife within people has played out over generations. And it's the drama of the West, right? Jealousy, greed, vengeance, all of those things play out through land ownership in multi-generational families.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also some beauty that plays out. I see that with your mom a lot, right? Her love of place, her love of you and Adele, and like so much pride in support in the way that she wants you to come back and express your own personalities in that long-term relationship that your family has.
Yeah, there's selflessness, there's altruism.
Totally.
It is a great drama, and mm-hmm. whether it's a comedy or a tragedy, you know, yet to be told. But largely, I think that agriculture is a tragedy.
It totally is.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the tragedy in agriculture comes from land ownership, right? And the different ways that we try to conceptualize what that means. Because for some people on the land, and I'll use your mom again as an example, that relationship between the human and that place that the human knows so well, and, you know, you can... There's so much emotion there, right? It's like your pet, your child. When the land is suffering, you feel that suffering and you feel responsibility for ending it in some way, or, you know, trying to make it better.
Even if it's completely beyond your control.
Totally, right?
You know, whether that's drought, like you can watch landowners here who are connected to their homes when it's dry, and you can see a physical pain in the way they move their body around. It's amazing.
And the anxiety, just like anytime somebody that you love is suffering, there's a baseline level of anxiety there because you are so aware of that suffering. And that's what happens in drought, where you just, you look at a place you know so well and you know that it's not okay. Mm-hmm. That all the indications of function and health and resilience are, you know, you don't see them.
Yeah. So where does your story start?
It's a good question. In a lot of ways, it's like you. It starts generations ago, and I think...
Was Carmen the original name?
No.
Who were the ancestors that founded the ranch?
Weinhard was the original name.
Weinhard. That sounds German,
mm-hmm.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And about what year would that have been?
So, Jacob Weinhard had already set up a business, land, kind of a brewery, a theater, all these things in Dayton, Washington.
Oh, no kidding.
And it was really...
You can almost see that from here, you know?
I know.
Yeah.
One of my grandma's favorite stories is that she and her little sister, I think she was maybe 12 or 13, when they rode their horses from our ranch in Wallowa to Dayton to visit her grandparents. And she talked about how she thought she was so independent and so resourceful and wild to take off on this journey that took them a couple days. And later she realized that her parents had neighbors and homesteaders set up all the way along the journey. They were basically checking on them and making sure that they got there and sending them on to the next stop.
That is the 1800s equivalent of like tracking your kid's iPhone.
Exactly. I know. Now I just look on Snapchat and I'm like, that's not where he said he was.
We're going to talk about this.
Yeah. All right. Text him and say, where are you? Yeah. Even though I'm watching them.
So they were set up in Dayton. How did they get to Wallowa?
Jacob had one son and three daughters that sort of lived into adulthood. And that one son was, I believe they sent him to brewing school because the primary business the Weinhard family overall was in was beer brewing. Mm. And
very German.
Very German.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love this.
And so Fritz was to take over the family business. He was sent to brewery school in Chicago with some other famous brewers, is the family lore. And when he came back, he was actually buying cattle to eat the barley mash left over from the what we now call dried distiller's grain. And one day he bought a whole herd of cattle. And again, the family legend is that his father said to him, well, apparently the boy wants to be a rancher. And so they traveled around the region looking for suitable land to have a ranch. And they went to Montana and the weather was horrible and it was a blizzard. And then they ended up in Wallowa County. And it's the stories of bunchgrass, you know, everywhere, beautiful pasture. And so Jacob traded land that he had in Dayton for the original home place and that was in 1913.
That was a good piece of land in 1913. So that would have been somebody who came maybe 30 years earlier, gave it a try.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, this isn't working out.
Exactly.
I want out of this. I'm going back to town.
Yeah. Whereas your people were the very first ones that came through. My people came in through that second generation and traded out for the homesteaders that it didn't work.
That's smart. You know, we talked about this in the Hell's Canyon episode, but a lot of the people that were coming in the early 1900s, if they didn't have something to trade, they were just getting what was left. And that was some rough ground. That was the shit down in the canyons and the rocks and cactus that nobody would ever like dream of trying to run a cow on.
Right.
So you guys did well, because that is a really dynamic and beautiful piece of the county, where you have, you know, some highland, you've got the ag land down in the bottom, you've got the timber.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a sweet spot.
And the original story was that my family came into a place of abundance, right?
Yeah.
And a place of opportunity. But I think the thing that's really interesting to me is our story is very different, and that is starting to really have to reckon with the amount of degradation that happened over those generations. And not in a spiteful way, not in a like, oh, I know so much better. It's really just acknowledging that our ancestors did the very best that they knew how to do with the information they had and the constraints that they were working under. But that meant that the workhorses had to be close to the home place. So all of that ground is now annual grasses. Mm-hmm. It meant that they had to have a cow herd year round. So a lot of places were overgrazed. It meant that they tilled because they believed that they could improve the species from the native grasses to the tame grasses that were so much more palatable. And they didn't realize in doing that, replacing those species, they destroyed the structure. They destroyed the root bases, right? So, and then the generation before us compensated for all of that degradation that was happening at a very, very slow level, because that's when they had fertilizer and herbicide, and you could just fix it, right? You could see even more productivity. But our generation, it's not, those things aren't working as much anymore. And so I think our generation is marked in part by that transition. And what I feel my job is that transition into a time where climate is more unstable. Degradation is the story of the West and of grazing and farming here. And there's still some huge forces that are pushing us towards decisions that extract from the land. Yet there's like a imperative as a species in order for us to survive that we create some new models. And it's both frustrating and exciting and depressing and challenging. But I think that that's the calling of the moment. And there are so many really cool people that are at work trying to solve for that.
You went to high school where?
Wallawa.
Wallawa. Sorry about that.
I didn't have a great time.
And then where did you go to college?
Stanford.
What did you study?
Environmental policy.
Environmental policy in Stanford. That's a big move from Wallawa.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like what they were saying was correct? It's definitely a time in our lives where we're clicked in both to learning something new and questioning everything.
Right.
And you had plenty of experience in what you thought you knew at the time. You know, I commonly hear from rural kids that study agriculture, environmental science, things like that, that what they're hearing from academia, they know to be untrue. But then there's other things that, you know, are really great takeaways that they're able to bring home again. Mm-hmm. So did you have either of those experiences?
Initially, no. And I was very purposeful as one can be when they're 18, in my decision to go there. I wanted to study ag. I knew I wanted to be involved in agriculture. But I also felt like I had a real responsibility is not quite the right word, but a desire to give back to our community. I felt like this community has something really special, mm-hmm. and that there is something distinct about rural places that can inform how you can live and how you can show up. I mean, there, community is this word we use all the time, but I think very few people understand and feel what community actually means.
Are you meaning that from like a tribal standpoint? What do you mean?
So when I think about the way people throw the word community around, it's often in the context of gathering around an issue or...
like a collective effort?
A collective effort or a collective conversation or even somebody you could call and talk to about something specific. When I think about the community that shows up in Wallowa County, I think of the ways that people are accountable for the others around them. I mean, our sense of interdependence, as much as we are independent, our sense of interdependence and our ability to see people for who they are and who they're trying to be, rather than, you know, what they're wearing or where they might identify politically. There's a nuance there that's really important. And I think that, you know, a sense of hospitality, right? A sense of you give and you don't know when that is going to come back to you, but it doesn't matter because that's what it feels like to be part of community. So there's a depth there that I think is more apparent in rural places, probably not all rural places, but certainly ours. So.
I thought it was interesting when I was in Kansas last December. I was in a real small place called Burdette that I'm not even sure had humans in it. I didn't see any besides just who was there in this old bank that had been converted to a hunting lodge. Still had the vault doors in it and stuff. But in town, you didn't see like vehicles parked outside houses. There's not lights on. It was very dust bowlish. Mm-hmm. Lots of tumbleweed stacked up in places. There are houses that you can get for free if you're just willing to live in them. Burdette, fun fact. The guy that discovered Pluto was from and in Burdette, Kansas, when he did it. One of the really interesting things, though, and what I'm driving at here, is I made a stop about an hour and a half away at a friend of a friend's butcher shop. The guy said, hey, my buddy has a butcher shop here. It's on the way. Why don't you stop in, grab a piece of jerky, see what they do. In Kansas, if nothing else, is about killing a lot of cattle.
Yep.
Lots and lots every day.
Feeding a lot and killing a lot.
Yep.
Yep.
And they asked where we were going. I said, oh, we're going to Burdette. This guy goes, I've never heard of that. I said, well, have you lived here a long time? He goes, yeah, my whole life. It's an hour and a half away.
Wow.
There's nobody here that you could talk about any town within 3 or 4 hours of here that not everyone has heard of. Like, everyone has heard of everything within this vicinity.
Yep.
And I thought that was interesting that they were that insulated.
Yep.
Or insular, maybe, is the better word. That's different here. And that's a very rural place, but it's rural with a totally different flavor than what you're talking about.
Yep. It's true. And having spent a certain amount of time in Kansas and working with some producers in Kansas, I agree that the culture is very... always often felt that there was a sense of hopelessness in some of the small towns that I visited in particular. There, it didn't feel like there was opportunity.
Yeah. And I think that there is. But I definitely understand what you mean, that it didn't feel like there was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was really interesting. Beautiful in its own way. Where I was not, I think I was an hour or more from Dodge City. And it was fun to think about it from that perspective, because I know that My great-grandfather took cattle from here to Dodge twice.
That's crazy, isn't it?
It is. Can you imagine? Bonkers. It would take over a year.
Yeah.
I tried to figure out like how you would time the snow and the passes. Mm-hmm. You know, how far you can move a herd of cattle in a day, river crossing, stuff like that. It would take over a year to make it there and back again. Pretty. Just to get them to market.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Pretty interesting, isn't
it? Yeah. You've been extremely, not extremely, exceptionally innovative in your approaches to agriculture. Is that just how Corey Carmen rolls, or did that stem from the opportunity that you got at a unique education?
So going back to the point that we got sidetracked from, I felt that we come from a really unique and special place that has a lot to offer. And yet I grew up in a time when there was a huge power struggle. And it was sort of the...
Within your own family or just within the community?
No, in terms of the conversations that we were having, whether it was about the spotted owl or... Yeah. Right? I mean, it was... There was a power struggle where it was sort of the people on the land, timber and ranching communities versus conservation environmental communities. And that conversation really informed how I thought about the world. And... I left with two distinct perspectives. One was a really naive perspective that if people just understood that, you know, we were just out here trying to make a living, they would work with us instead of trying to take everything away from us. Mm-hmm. And then the other perspective that I had was that I really felt like the community had raised me. And it was, you know, part of it was that my dad died right as I was starting high school, and there were so many people that showed up for me. I mean, friends of his, acquaintances. I mean, it was, again, that sense of community where if my steer needed to be clipped for the fair, John Johnson was there, you know, walking me through the whole thing. Or Dennis Sheehy would, you know, have these kind of deep conversations with me about some of the experiences that he had. I mean, there was just a laundry list of people that showed up, and they didn't have to, and made sure that I was okay. And then this tiny high school, there were 18 people in my graduating class, sent me off into the world with a pile of scholarships that was pretty unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And so I left with a sense of, again, I don't know quite what the right words are, but like I was honored for what people had done, and I felt like there was such amazing value that I wanted to repay that in my own way.
Yeah. That was the same experience that I had and the same driving force that I had to go to the military. We've mm-hmm. talked about that before. But it's interesting, you know, we continue to talk about the parallels that we have in our lives mm-hmm. and the really, you know, I guess eventually unique approaches we've taken to agriculture.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. We're just products of our time and community
yeah.
in a lot of ways.
Yeah. But, and, you know, obviously there's a connection to place. There's a stubbornness, I think.
Oh yeah.
I mean,
how would you survive without it here?
Yeah.
If you weren't stubborn, you'd just have to quit.
It's true.
There's not a version of optimism that can survive.
Yeah.
Stubborn's it.
I think, I know for me, I probably would have innovated more often if I wasn't so stubborn. But I don't know. I think you don't learn as much if you don't really, really sit with the problem for a long time. Mm. So it's a trade-off.
That's a place where we differ in our approaches. Because I don't sit with problems for any extra amount of time, minimal amount of time.
You move on.
Or move through.
So what is it? Tell me what that looks like.
I accept a 70% solution. So if I feel like there's a 70% chance that the solution that I have will work, then I'm going to do it right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sitting with it. If it looks like that's going wrong, I'll abandon it and start over. I'll start something new.
But, now, would you do that in, say, a business model context?
Yeah. Oh, I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, even more so.
So what are some examples of business model that you felt really good about that you then then you realize like, oh, this isn't working?
Well, early with a fly fishing business, I got taken advantage of by the people that I was working with because they basically paid me nothing and then paid for access to the ranch. So I was getting money to grant access to a really, really special stretch of river and place, and then was providing my time and gear and expertise to these anglers and making nothing for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very much taken advantage of there, but it was just a quick decision to go that route.
Mm-hmm.
And when I realized that was happening, I made another quick decision to make sure that stopped happening.
Yeah.
I'm going to try a different scotch. My friend Weston Rogers gave me this. Have you heard this one before? I don't even know how to pronounce it.
Mm-mm.
Glenarnock 18. It's nice. I mean, the reviews are nice. I haven't tried it before, but I'm going to. Okay. What is the Carmen Ranch?
Carmen Ranch is two things.
At least.
Well, from a business standpoint, from business structure.
Mm-hmm.
There's the family ranch
mm-hmm.
that, you know, again, has been in my family since 1913. And that is a specific business tied to land, includes leases, a few enterprises. And increasingly, I think we think of ourselves as a little bit of a learning experimentation. We're actually doing some research trials. I think we're in a really interesting location right as you come into the valley. We're sort of at that interface between the rest of the world and this like really unique, beautiful, diverse place. And so again, feeling some responsibility, opportunity. How can we help people understand? How can we trial new ideas? How can we welcome people and represent at least a part of or a little bit of an insight into a much larger culture tradition? But at the end of the day, we have cow-calf. We do finishing. We sell direct via cow shares and pig shares. We have a few sheep. We're a little ranch.
The question that I had originally wanted to start the show with, I'm going to ask you right now.
Okay.
What is a brand?
It's a good question. And I don't know that I have a good answer.
Yeah. There's a few answers, right?
Mm-hmm. Well.
It's a metal object that.
Right.
You know, you either get hot or cold to prove that you own an animal.
It's a mark.
Yeah.
That means something way beyond the mark. And right, in the cultural context that you and I come from, it signifies ownership.
Mm-hmm.
But also, right, you see a brand on an animal, and then that cues an owner up in your mind, which cues... I better get out of the way, or I want to call them right now because I really care about them, or they're going to be, I mean, right? It whoever that owner is cues up a whole story.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in some ways it's a great example, right?
And there's a reason that a lot of ranches, dare I say most, are named after their brand.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think there's more ranches named after their brand than after the family that owns it.
Yeah, that's a great point.
I think it's funny that we talk about branding in advertising and branding in business, and people talk about their personal brands, and it is so quickly escaped normal conversation where that comes from. And it's not a relic. we still brand.
Yep. It's a great point, and it's a great analogy that I hadn't actually ever made, is the brands that are so familiar to us that have a history and an emotional resonance and, you know, even consequences or an affiliation with quality. When you see a brand on an animal, you can conjure up all of those things. And I think that's the aspiration for a brand, call it in the marketplace, is to conjure up a whole emotional resonance and a story that ideally is positive.
Right. And most brands, I guess, if we're talking about like larger corporate world today, come down to how we recognize them through their logo or insignia, which just takes it full circle back to its origins.
Totally.
You know, if people think Nike, they think of the swoosh before they think of the four letters.
Yep, absolutely.
Yep.
And when you say the word Nike, the swoosh is, you have a mental image in your mind of the swoosh, right? Which is pretty powerful.
People ask a lot why the Six Ranch is called the Six Ranch. And, you know, the reality is it's called the Six Ranch because our brand is the number six. Why our brand is the number six, I do not know.
Really?
I don't know. I don't know why they picked that. I think maybe it was the sixth brand registered in the state. And one through five were taken. I don't know.
Yeah. Or there was a branding iron available and that brand was...
Yeah.
What, who knows?
What's left?
Mm-hmm.
What's your brand?
Bar HC.
Bar HC.
Mm-hmm.
And then what is that? What does that mean? Where did that come from?
So that was my grandpa Hoy's brand, and it was Hoy Carmen.
Okay.
The original Weinhardt brand was a J7 brand, but we don't use that one anymore.
Yeah.
We just use the Bar HC.
Do you still have the registry on it?
Mm-hmm.
On J7?
Oh, I don't know that I do.
No. Scoop it up.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Before this podcast airs.
You got a week.
Yeah, I don't know that. It's not like a web domain. There's maybe not a line of people.
Be surprised. I mean, look at the brands that get registered now. They're like alphabets.
Yeah.
They have to be so complex because all the simple ones are long gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
I should do a show just on brands. That would be tricky to do through audio.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody's going to know what a, you know, Rock and Dash Sunset is. Whatever. That's a dumb idea. I'm not going to do that show.
But I can't wait for you to draw the Rock and Dash Sunset brand. James is busy for the rest of today.
Okay. So then, in a larger sense, you apply your brand to cattle that were never on your place, right?
Right. So there's a second business, and its real name is Carmen Ranch Provisions.
Mm.
And that business buys cattle from producers in the Northwest, from Montana into Washington and into other parts of Oregon. And we sell the resulting meat from those cattle under the Carmen Ranch brand.
Do you have standards that those cattle have to meet?
I get asked that a lot, and a lot of times people give me credit, like, oh, well, you came up with these production standards, and you told all your producers that they had to, as if it's a dictatorship and I'm the boss, which, in theory, I like that idea, but it's really not how it worked at all. You know, my journey has really been in, and your family has a similar journey. It seems so straightforward that as ranchers, we should be able to raise cattle on really beautiful, diverse pasture and sell the resulting meat to people that value health, ecological function, sustainability, animal welfare, whatever the entry point is for a particular consumer.
And a nice steak or burger.
And yeah, flavor. It just seems like that should be a real thing that you could make a living doing.
And then
that.
You make enough money doing that that you can keep doing it.
Right.
And still be able to, you know, buy a pair of Nikes for your kid who wants to run in circles at school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you don't necessarily accumulate wealth in a job like that. but you're not living on the edge all the time. Mm-hmm. That seems, because the wealth that you get in a job like that is, it comes in these ways that you don't measure. And that's a lifestyle decision, mm-hmm. right? The beautiful sunsets, the time with the animals, that there's a million things that you get in a job like that that can outweigh, call it accumulation of wealth. But that's hard to do. And it shouldn't be hard to do. And that one reality of looking at my own family ranch and how much we were struggling, especially, so I lived in LA when I moved home to the ranch, and I had gone to farmers markets, worked in the restaurant industry. I mean, I saw people's awareness of food in Southern California in a way that I had never seen anywhere. I didn't know existed, right? And this is in, you know, early 2000s. And so it seemed like it should be not even that hard to connect people that had an ethos about where their food was from a health, sustainability, and even, you know, their own relationship to food with the work that we were doing as a way of maintaining economic viability. And then I also had a real challenge, and this is back to your question earlier about, you know, when I showed up at Stanford, did I think they were wrong or right or right? And it was none of those things. It was really, if my role was to be a spokesperson for my community, and I had this privilege of being sent out into the world, then my job, again, from that vantage point, was to represent our community in a really positive way. And when I realized that the people I was around, their understanding of the beef industry and of livestock came from driving through feedlots or seeing feedlots. So I really wanted to convey to them that my experience, that a place like Wallowa County, our experience with raising livestock wasn't connected to a feedlot.
Yeah.
It was a really different experience.
Yeah, people get it so twisted. I remember listening to a Rogan episode that had a really popular hunter on there, and he was talking about how awful animal agriculture was and how much better he was than everybody else because, you know, he ate elk and deer. And like, that's fine. And that's a common enough thing that, like, mm-hmm. especially hunters from town like to do.
Yeah.
And one of the ads that Rogan had on that episode was for Omaha Steaks.
Should have thought that one through.
So funny to me. And I was like, man, you guys are all so full of shit. You don't know what you're talking about. Like, you're trying to know what you're talking about, but you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fine. Like, Omaha Steaks is fine. It's fine if you want to eat deer or elk. It's fine if you want to buy your burger from the Dollar General. I don't care. Like, there's a time and a place for all that. But we also need to respect that there are a lot of different ways that beef gets produced.
Yep.
And if caring about the environment is part of your life, then you need to take a really close look at the way that beef is produced in ways that promote healthy environments.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's such an opportunity, right? I mean, the incumbent industrial system exists as a byproduct of policy.
I can already tell that this is a sentence I'm not going to be able to understand. What are you talking about?
Totally. James Nash, you are one of the smartest people I know. Don't even pretend.
Okay. All right. Sorry. I broke your stride there. That was starting to be a Nils Kristofferson answer that, you know, he himself couldn't understand. Let's try it again.
Existing.
Okay.
Industrial system.
Yep.
The existing beef system.
Yeah.
Right? It is a byproduct mm-hmm. of consumer demand and policy.
Yeah.
And it's fine. It served when all we wanted was a way to utilize overproduction of grain mm-hmm. and stabilize our farming community, at least the part that produced certain crops.
Right.
And to have access to cheap protein from a nutritional standpoint. I mean, we did, as a culture, as a country, we nailed it.
And a lot of what consumers demand is that it's cheap food.
Totally. And, you know, it's really fascinating. I mean, that conversation around how we don't mind. I mean, we are such a consumeristic, is that a word? Culture?
Sure.
Consumerism drives people's ideas of pleasure and quality of life. And I mean, it's reinforced constantly. And yet we simultaneously think that it is a right to have access to cheap food. Mm-hmm. And that if you spend a lot of money on food or you buy food that is expensive, it's kind of like you're being swindled or you're, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, how would you characterize those people, right? What's the stereotype of the people that buy precious food?
Yeah.
They're like elite.
There's some elitist aspects to it. I see memes all the time, and memes are such a fun way of communication.
Totally.
About like people just wanting to make enough money that they're not mad about how much a bag of beef jerky costs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you ever made jerky?
Yeah.
It's hard.
It's really hard.
And you start with 25 pounds of meat and you end up with half a pound.
Right.
And yeah, jerky's wonderful. But if you, you know, like say it costs, you know, $25 to buy a pound of beef jerky. I mean, you just bought 8 pounds of meat.
Totally.
And a lot of labor, so much labor and time, mm-hmm. and smoke and spices. So there's just that vast disconnection between process and entitlement for cheap food.
Yep. Well, and what, where did that, I mean, I'm just curious about where that came from. Because as a culture, we don't mind spending money on certain things. Everybody has...
entertainment.
I was going to say everybody has a phone and they have subscriptions to half a dozen different streaming services and...
entertainment and communication, I think we'll spend a lot of money on.
Mm-hmm.
Looks.
Good point.
You know, you look at the richest people in the world, and recently it's gone back and forth between some dude in France who owns makeup companies and Elon Musk.
Yeah.
Right? So we've got transportation, communication, and looks.
Yeah.
And I think that it's interesting that it's not a Monsanto, it's not a Tyson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people that control the food systems are definitely rich, but they're not as rich as the people who change how you appear to others.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Yeah, so somewhere along the line, we decided it was worth spending money on certain foods, mm-hmm. coffee, chocolate, wine, right? That's okay.
Scotch. God bless them. This is really good, by the way. You should
is
try
it?
This one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
I
bet.
Get to that stage in your
I'm
drink.
I'm close.
Yeah.
But the basic foods, we are still functioning in a paradigm where the foods that should nourish us the most and really contribute not only to our individual health, but to our collective health through the ecological implications of raising them, those are the ones that people have the most struggle paying a little bit more for.
You know what's something that people feel entitled to pay nothing for that is more valuable than almost anything is water.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
People think that water should be free.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to change.
I thought you were going to say time.
I don't know. That gets into like this bigger physics conversation that I'm not smart enough to sink my teeth into.
But, okay, great.
Yeah. Water's a really interesting one. And my little sister was over last night. You know, she's living in the cabin where I used to live. And every time I left there was no way for me to escape without going past at least two neighbors that wanted to stop and talk about a ditch.
Yep.
And I lived in constant fear of having to talk to a neighbor about a ditch
and now that's on her. And we were out burning our ditch the other day, and she doesn't have a great track record with fire, so I was lending help and unwelcome criticism.
Uh-huh.
And I said, you know, there's nothing like burning ditches to get your neighbors to burn ditches. And she kind of chuckled at that. And the next day, we had neighbors as far as you could see, like just lines of smoke racing down the dirt roads. It was awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, that was, I got the call yesterday because we don't burn our ditches.
Mm.
And I got the call yesterday from a neighbor, because whenever you do something a little bit outside of the box in a community, people perceive it as a criticism.
Sure.
Of what they're doing.
Yeah.
Whether it's right. It's a really unique kind of cultural nuance. And so I got the call yesterday. I would like to know why you don't believe in burning your ditches. Yeah. Is there a reason besides the fence? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People don't know. They don't know the fight that's coming over water. And the reason I'm talking about ditches is that's because that's how our water moves around. Whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And as water, you know, becomes scarce or becomes expensive or owned, or, you know, coming soon to Southern and Central California, overly abundant, because they've got 90 feet of snow in the Sierras. It's going to melt off at some point. Yeah, water's a big deal. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the Klamath, with dam removal. Everybody thinks that that's this, you know, silver bullet that's going to save everything. Snake River dam removal, another hot ticket item. But yeah, on the local level for us, it's ditches.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm going to do a show at some point with either the Water Master or one of the ditch walkers, just to, you know, kind of show the world what that life is like.
Our Water Master is pretty phenomenal.
Yeah.
His ability to, I mean, the amount of social skills.
Oh my God.
That it takes.
And then continuing to live in a community.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oof.
And he's really adept in how he navigates. I mean, he both has a backbone, mm-hmm. and diplomacy.
And solution finding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. I scooped a spot out that they got wet down here, mm-hmm. for ducks. I wanted some waterfowl habitat. And one of my neighbors ratted me out because that's Kate Brown's water. I'm not allowed to impede that water's path.
Slow it down. Yeah.
I guess Tina Kotek's water now. But
anyways...
One of my neighbors ratted me out. So the Water Master called me and he's like, look, we need to talk about this. I was like, oh, it's a historic water feature. And, you know, he showed me satellite imagery going back to the 70s. He's like, no, it's not. And I was like, ah, you're right. It's not. He's like, but what it is a bulge in the system. I was like, a bulge in the system? And he said, yes, it is a bulge in the system, which you're allowed to have if it meets within these specifications. And he's like, next time, just talk to me first. I was like, okay, so now I've got I do not have a pond, but I have a bulge in the system, which I am allowed to have. But that's great, you know,
that
was, you know, one of the most positive experiences I've had with a government official that was, you know, just looking for a solution, trying to figure it out, wants to continue living in the community. And if you go around pissing people off, over trivial things, then you're not going to be able to continue living here.
Right. And there are a variety of different perspectives that people come to, especially in government offices, right, that have a sort of enforcement component to it. You can come in with an ego and the idea that you have power, or somebody like David is really about finding solutions, mm-hmm. and really about supporting the community, landowners. So it's fun. It's fun to have him around.
Yeah. What do you want to leave the people with? What's your message to a 16-year-old girl and small town America, living on her family ranch, wondering what her future is going to be like. What do you say to her?
There are so many opportunities for people that want to be on the land, but they're very hard. It's hard to see them. They don't show up in Google searches. And so don't be discouraged, but find mentors. And those mentors show up in a lot of different places, but people that have been on the land for a long time, that are quietly doing the work, those are the people that are really teach you how to think and teach you how to problem solve. And so always seek out those people and have a long view.
And if people are sick of the beef that they're eating, how do they get some Carmen Ranch beef in their life?
They can go to our website, and we do delivery in Portland. And they can also go to, we have restaurant partners in Seattle and Portland. We're at all the New Seasons grocery stores in Portland. We even have a few customers that sell our meat in the Bay Area and Sacramento.
Okay, there we go. 10 out of 10 would recommend to a friend. All right, this is going to be part one. You're not off the hook. I don't feel like we even got there yet.
I have my whole list of questions.
Okay, I'll give you one. Give you one.
Okay, great. Oh, this is going to be hard. How important is it that people have a connection to land?
My staff sergeant, when I was in the Marines, John Xavier, brilliant Marine, excellent leader, incredible tanker, and a good friend. John pointed out to me one time that I asked everyone where they were from, and that wasn't a normal thing. I didn't know that wasn't a normal thing. And that was the first time that I realized that it wasn't necessarily important to me where somebody was from so much as it was important to me where I was from, because I feel like it's the biggest part of who I am, that, you know, this place is the forge. It is the anvil. It is the hammer. Without that connection to place, I don't think you can reach your potential. You might be able to reach a very different potential because it's also an anchor. And maybe it's grounding, maybe it's an anchor. I don't know. But for me, it's critically important to my identity.
Yep.
Does that answer your question?
I think so. But you've worked with a lot of people that haven't had connection to place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I think that that they can get that. They can get that if they want it. And it doesn't necessarily have to be where they live. It can be a place that they visit. Mm-hmm. It can be a place that they visit physically. It can be a place that they visit in their mind or through education. We have a tremendous ability now to have a connection with a place that we're not physically in.
Okay, so I have one. It's a follow-up.
Okay.
What's the difference between connecting to place through recreation and through agriculture, or is that the wrong distinction?
It is very difficult to distinguish what I do between the two.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's a real difference between somebody harvesting carrots from their garden and me shooting a deer on the hillside above the garden, except that venison is better than carrots.
It's a lot more freaking work too. Okay.
Just different work. So for what I do, I don't know if I would really classify it in a way that it's like purely recreation and not purely agriculture or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends where your mind is when you're recreating. Are you trying to experience a place? Are you trying to deepen your connection with it? Are you trying to take something from it?
Mm-hmm. So maybe the distinction is about accountability.
Oh, almost always.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can be in agriculture and it can be, you can have a garden, but that doesn't impact whether or not you pay your bills that week or that month. And you can be hunting in a recreational way or backpacking and have a great sense of appreciation, but it doesn't necessarily impact your ability to sustain your livelihood.
Yeah. Yeah. Depending on like what your livelihood is.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are good questions.
Oh, I got more.
I know you do. Corey has this this incredible ability to eschew small talk.
You know what it is? It's a deficiency. I don't know how to do small talk.
Yeah.
So it just cuts straight to the good stuff.
Yeah. That's great. Something that I've always both relished and dreaded about the times that we do get to hang out and talk is that you tend to cut directly to the chase of like whatever it is I'm most afraid of talking about with anyone else.
And it's my...
the times that I do get to hang out with you, we talk about just the best of things, the best of things.
I agree.
And that's why you have to come back.
Okay.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think we covered it. For the most part, CarmenRanch.com.
Yep.
There's a link in the podcast description. Bay Area, Seattle, Portland, Wallowa. Can people buy stuff locally, Wallowa County?
A little bit, yeah.
A little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Six Ranch has a really good presence in Wallowa County.
Yeah. Both of us do.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Cheers, Corey.
Thanks, James.
About a decade ago, I launched my old aluminum drift boat onto a remote whitewater river and floated for a couple sunny spring days to meet some friends who were bear hunting downstream. While I made them dinner that evening, one of my buddies came over and showed me a SIG rangefinder. I'd heard of the company and I'd seen their gear while I was a Marine, but this was the first time I'd seen one of their products built for hunters. The range popped up instantly, and it continued to range everything I put the reticle on as I scanned across the canyon. I'd never seen anything like it on the civilian market, and frankly, not on the military one either. Since that day, SIG has come out with a long list of high-quality and innovative products for hunters, as well as continuing the same for military, law enforcement, and responsible citizens. They have some great training facilities located around the country, too. Check out all that SIG has to offer on their website, SIGSauer.com. And this episode of the podcast is brought to you by SIG. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and share the show with a friend. You can also rate the podcast and leave a review. Your support allows me to keep doing what I love, which is meeting incredible folks and sharing their stories with you. For more content and photos, follow the show on Instagram at Six Ranch Podcast or me at Six Ranch Outfitters. This episode was produced by Emily Brannigan with original music written and performed by Justin Hay. Art for the Six Ranch Podcast was created by John Chatelain and digitized by Celia Christofferson. Tune in every Monday for a brand new episode of the Six Ranch Podcast. I'll catch you next week.